Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.
Happy Monday, everybody, and thank you so much for tuning in to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill. I am so happy to be here today and to be back from my trip. Believe it or not, I did miss you guys, and I missed doing the show, though I heard Allison Garrido did an amazing job guest hosting for us, as always. And today, what a perfect way to be back in the studio, because we have a very apropos topic today, and that is career strategies. What are the career strategies that you should be employing today in a modern society, and how have those changed over the last 5 or 10 years? So to speak with us today, I have in studio with me Gideon Grunfeld. Gideon, thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's such a delight. So for those of you who might not know about Gideon's background, Gideon is a former human resources professional, consultant, and employment law attorney. And since 2004, he has been the president of Success Career Strategies. SCS is based in Los Angeles and helps attorneys and other professionals make career transitions and manage their careers more effectively, which is what we're going to be discussing today. Gideon started his own career in the human resources field. After graduating from the University of Pennsylvania with a degree in economics, Gideon worked as a consultant at National Economic Resource Associates and was a human resources manager for both ADP and a nonprofit teaching hospital with 5,000 employees. Gideon was a lawyer in Los Angeles and D.C. for almost 10 years, and we forgive him for that. I'm just kidding. I work with a lot of lawyers. This included advising corporations such as Pepsi and Ralph Lauren about a range of employment law issues. He was also part of a trial team that successfully defended John Deere in one of the largest age discrimination lawsuits in the country. Gideon writes and speaks extensively about career-related issues. He wrote the career advice column for the online jobs portal EmployerNet, and his speeches address topics such as how to create your career roadmap, how to get paid what you are worth. Gideon is also a member of the National Speakers Association and is the former president of its Los Angeles chapter. So you have a very wide breadth of experience, don't you, Gideon?
Some people say I can't keep a job myself, which is how I became an expert in helping others map their careers.
So talk to us a little bit about your personal transition. It sounds like you started as an attorney and then moved into HR. So tell us a little bit about how that came about.
It actually happened in the other direction. So I started in HR.
Got it.
And so that was very much an interest that I developed, strangely enough, even in high school. I had sort of a strange formative experience when I was 17 years old. I went to a small, very close-knit private high school outside of Philadelphia where everybody knew each other. And one of the sort of important missions of that school was everybody was communal and supportive. And one of the things that I found out when I was 17, in the summer after I graduated and before I actually started college, is that the vice principal of the school had been fired. And the way that I found out is that I walked into the faculty lounge and I saw a notice on the board, on the bulletin board, announcing that opening. And the fact that I found out that way doesn't make much of a difference. But what really intrigued me is that's how he found out, too.
Oh, no. That is an employment law nightmare.
Well, especially for a place that really prides itself on community and spirituality and all of these highfalutin kinds of things. And I was very much intrigued when I was 17 trying to figure out, like, how can that be? How can you have such a big difference between
disparity
between what an organization stands for and what it actually does, or at least sometimes does? And that's what happened. And so I was very much interested in that, took classes in college in economics and HR and labor economics, and started right after college working both as a consultant on employment issues and then finally in HR, both for ADP and for a large teaching hospital in Philadelphia. So that's kind of what inspired me to get started in that field.
So that's fascinating, though, because I think I know people who have kind of gone the opposite direction, where perhaps they've started as an attorney and then they've transitioned into HR. So after you already had a thriving career in HR, why transition into becoming an attorney?
It was more a function. I mean, a lot of people ask me that question. A lot of people, including my parents. And a lot of people ask me that question. It basically boiled down to that in a lot of organizations, the HR department isn't really respected all that much, was my experience. People respect the skill set that people in HR bring to the table, but they don't necessarily have as much power to get things done. And a lot of the issues that I was dealing with as an HR executive involved the lawyers and the law department, and it became sort of a way for me to see if I could be more effective. And that's sort of how I transitioned into it. And as a lawyer, I ended up starting doing a lot of work representing employers and advising a lot of employers on a whole range of employment issues.
Fascinating. And so that must have been a great marriage of the two skills, because you already had the ground level foundation knowledge of human resources, and then you got to couple that with a law degree and your writing skills and your analytical abilities.
Yeah, it worked out really well, in part because I had a common language. As you know, when you're as a recruiter, when you are dealing with the people who are making hiring decisions, when you know what that's like, when you've been in that chair, when you've been in that room, when employees are coming to you or supervisors are coming to you. And I was really fortunate that I had a wide array of issues that I dealt with as an HR executive, everything from salary negotiations and union negotiations. And I did just basically reviewing resumes every day and making hiring decisions. And I also, for a period of time, I did sexual harassment investigations. I mean, I was blessed to really have a lot of different kinds of experiences, which did come in handy when I became a lawyer and I was advising those people as to what to do and what not to do.
So then, after 10 years, so you started in HR, you transitioned into becoming an attorney. After 10 years practicing, what had you finish practicing as an attorney?
It certainly wasn't to get away from lawyers, I'll tell you that much, because I spend probably as much time advising lawyers and law firms, and I spend more time with lawyers now than I probably did when I was one. It was much more just something that I needed to do in my own life. I have this strong entrepreneurial instinct. It's something I've always wanted to do. I knew there was going to be a period of time where I wanted to start my own business, and it was just the right time. In 2004, 2005, it was just the right time for me to go start a business. And it was the time for me to use my experience as a consultant, my experience in HR, my experience as a lawyer. And that's kind of what I used to start Successful Career Strategies.
I think that's brilliant, because from a big picture standpoint, I think that the breadth of experience that you gained in all those areas probably makes you a tremendous asset to the attorneys or to whoever it is you're consulting, because you have a wide variety of perspective of all sorts of different issues. And I know we were talking earlier, and you said the great thing is that you get to kind of go in and sometimes coach people on transitions, but also on leadership and other things amongst salary negotiation and different things related to careers. So I think it makes you a valuable asset wherever you go. So that leads into my question is, with respect to career strategies, you know, the advice that you're giving people now, is that different than the advice you were giving 5 or 10 years ago?
It absolutely is, because the world, if you've noticed, I mean,
just a little
has changed a little
just,
bit.
Just a little.
just think of what happened since you took vacation.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, so much has happened.
So if you extrapolate however long that vacation was, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the world has changed. And not only kind of superficially that you see people change jobs, but I think employment has changed. And for so many people, kinds of jobs, the whole gig economy, if you had talked to someone 10 years ago and tried to explain to them what Uber is.
Which is the best idea ever. I want to interview an Uber driver on this show because I love their stories.
And so the whole idea, it's not only that the technology would have been alien to them because cell phones wouldn't have made sense to them in the way they do now, but the whole idea of just sort of show up when you want to, or the whole idea of people who can work remotely or people who can structure their lives around their work in so many ways. The fact that you have so many people who aren't working traditional full-time jobs, you know, and that means there's lots of benefits to it, there are lots of drawbacks to it. So in that kind of world, and the world that's changing as quickly as it is, if you're going to keep up, I have to give people different advice than I did 15 years ago.
So what would you say to somebody who's entering the job market now and thinking of making a move?
I would say the single biggest thing you have to do is to change your mindset. Because the facts on the ground, what will happen to your current employer, what will happen to your industry, no one can predict for sure. What you can know is that the old way of doing things, which is I'm just going to do the best I can and keep my head down and stay out of trouble, and everything is certainly going to turn out okay, that doesn't make sense today in today's world. If you look at what happens to most of the people, even people who are very good at their jobs, aren't guaranteed of having a stable career, a successful career. So you have to take ownership of your career. You have to make decisions about your career in a much more assertive way, in a much more directed way, in a much more purposeful way than you needed to do 10 or 15 years ago. It doesn't mean it's bad, because you have a lot more options. But what I'm seeing out there is that the difference between winners and losers, and I hate to use the word losers because it doesn't mean that they're losers, but the people who are succeeding and those who aren't, is much bigger than it used to be. And it's not because those people are less smart or less diligent or worse at their job. It's a lot of times that they don't have a strategy. They're just doing their job day to day and sort of hoping for the best, as opposed to the people who have a plan and a strategy and are really taking ownership of their career.
It's so funny you bring that up. Like you said, so many people just live paycheck to paycheck. And I empathize. I can imagine, you know, when I was in college, I remember that I was in debt and lived paycheck to paycheck and sometimes didn't know how I was going to pay my bills that month. But now, having been in my career for over 14 years, I look back at my strategy, and every year for myself, I create a 5-year plan. And somebody once gave me great feedback to kind of look at your life and then plan and look backwards of how you got there. And even for some people, I don't know if this is your thing, but I love vision boards. And it kind of knocked my socks off the other day, because I have a vision board in my bathroom. And everything that was on my vision board that I ever had intended to get, it hit me like a ton of bricks. I have. Like, it's happened. And it was so humbling and something to be very grateful for. But like you said, most people just tend to react to circumstances and just live reactively, rather than a term that one of my spiritual guides said yesterday, which is response ability. It's your ability to respond to things rather than react that equals your success. Michael Beckwith had said that yesterday.
You know, and I think that mindset is incredibly important. It's empowering. But it's also not just the mindset. It's not just enough to say, I have a plan, I'm going to stick to it. I think a lot of it is that people aren't, through absolutely no fault of their own, provided the skill set or the mindset to make them succeed or to maximize the chances that they will succeed. So here's a specific example, something that I noticed when I transitioned from being an employee myself to being an entrepreneur myself. And that is, business owners have this thing called a mastermind group. Or there are many tools that they use to stay in touch and collaborate with other business owners to talk about issues and problems. It's something like, sometimes people refer to it as a personal board of advisors. They meet 3 times a year, 6 times a year. When's the last time you heard someone who's an employee do the same thing?
Love that. That's so true. I've never, of all the interviews I've done and conversations I've had, I never had somebody put it so succinctly. You're absolutely right. I have a business coach, a vocal coach, a this coach, a that coach. I have 20 coaches at any given time who are coaching me on different aspects of my business.
And that's absolutely one of the problems I run into, or one of the challenges I run into when I'm dealing with people who are in the business of giving legal advice. So I work with a lot of professional services companies, so accountants, lawyers, doctors. What do all those people have in common? They're full of themselves. I can say that. They are in the business of giving advice. Yes. They're not great at taking advice.
That's so true.
Right?
I struggle with that myself. I'm not going to lie.
Okay. But here's the thing. And so one of the things I tell lawyers in particular, because of the three groups, they by far struggle with this the most, is I give them the example. Take any great singer, performer, or athlete, anybody you admire. If you heard that, pick someone, Michael Jordan or Beyonce, they had a nutritionist and a masseuse and a masseur.
Of course, don't we all?
Right. And someone who helps them visualize, and someone helps them deal with stress, and someone who helps as a coach. You wouldn't say, well, they're terrible. Right. You would think that only elite people, or the people who are intending to be elite, get that kind of support system around them. And it's not only the nuts and bolts of what they do. It's the emotional aspect. It's the financial aspect. One of the key things that entrepreneurs know, that I wish a lot more employees know, is the way you run a successful business or any kind of enterprise is that you use other people's brains and other people's talents. And so I didn't need to give this kind of advice for career transitions 15, 20 years ago or 5 years ago. But now it's a team process. You have to think about who it is that you need to get around you. And a lot of people, they do this, but only when they are desperate looking for a job. They haven't talked to someone in 3 years. They haven't talked to, and they find out that person is now in a position to help them. And they say, remember me from 1997 or 5 years ago or 2 years ago? And then they want to get help. And they've never established a relationship. They never have done anything because they're reacting to the need. They're not thinking about what can I do for others? What can I contribute to a community? What can I do before I have that need to avoid that need? And it's a mindset that entrepreneurs and business owners have. And it makes sense that they have it because you can't really survive without it, or your learning curve would be so much slower without it. And it's something that day to day people just don't realize how critical it is and how achievable it is. It's not like you don't have to have some highfalutin degree, you don't have to have some title after your name. It's something that you can see sometimes people, they're 15, 16 year olds. You see Gen Xers, and they're getting it from day one that they need to go talk to other people. They need to establish relationships. They have that personal board of directors. They never think of it that way, but they do.
And it makes such a good point. I was just talking to my Uber driver yesterday. He was a recent college graduate from Michigan. And here he is Uber driving, and he was saying how saturated the market is. And I said, well, great. What are you going to do? What's next? And he's like, well, I don't know. I want to do sketch comedy. I want to do this. So I said, what are you doing about it? And that's the thing. So in that short span of a 10-minute Uber ride, I gave him 7 resources. Now, here's the other part, too, is following up. Whether you're a job seeker or an entrepreneur, if that gentleman, who was my Uber driver yesterday, follows up with any of the resources I gave him, guaranteed he will have a job within the next 3 months. But 50% of it is action. The other 50% of it is intention. And in my experience, it's your action times your intention that equals your success or employability. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think whether that's the exact formula, 50-50,
your
mileage may vary. But no, I think that's exactly right. Look, at the end of the day, you can't be surprised that as a human being, you need people to help you hold you accountable. People act as if, oh, everything I do, I set my, you know, a goal to work out, it always happens. I set my goal to save money, it always happens. I don't know about your life, but my life and the lives of everybody I see, especially if they're really successful people, and I don't mean only financially successful, they plan on the fact that I need support. I need a support system. I need a group of people who are going to hold me accountable. I need family and friends or whoever it is who are going to be truth tellers to me, because I can predict that my path to success isn't going to be this straight line. And I know, and what ends up happening is that people who get where they want to go, they're resilient because they don't get thrown off by the fact, oh, it's been a week since I promised to go to the gym, and then they don't go to the gym for the next
decade.
Because
they give up on it.
They give up. The people who are successful figure out, well, yeah, I probably need a buddy system. I need something. I need music. I need a goal. I need a workout. I need a particular competition to train for. They have some personalized internal knowledge. And if they don't have the knowledge, they go to other people and say, what are you doing? I see that you go to the gym all the time. I see that you've gotten promoted 3 times in 5 years. I see that you've went from this job to this job to this job and got more responsibility and more pay. What did you do? And people are trying to either reinvent the wheel by themselves between their own ears, or they don't realize that it's human to have a week or two or three where, okay, it didn't
manifest the way you anticipated.
Exactly right.
And that's the thing, though, is getting up. We've all been there. I've had my share of bad days or weeks or months, and I do everything with my power to mitigate it so that if I notice I'm in one of those spaces, I don't sit around and wallow in it. I call A, B, C, D, E, F, G, whether it's my husband, my business coach, my vocal coach, my spiritual advisor. Any one of those people is going to be a sounding board for me and say, hey, could it be this? Could it be that? And it's going to allow you to get back to being on the track of manifestation and creating a lot faster than if you sat around by yourself. Like a sole person we are amazing. I just read this somewhere. It's, you know, two minds are better than one and three minds are better than two. So it just goes on and on like that. And I think one of my favorite books that I first started hearing about the mastermind was Napoleon Hill, Think and Grow Rich. I'm sure. Have you read that one?
Of course.
Yeah. It's for any of our listeners out there. I think I may have mentioned this book once before on the show, but it bears mentioning again. It was the first book that really inspired me to think outside the box and to go look for what I called my strategic alliances or mastermind group. And as Gideon was saying, that's your foundation. It's, I think, Ford, even in the book, Napoleon Hill, correct me if I'm wrong on this, I think he mentions that Ford, who was our president, said, I'm not the brightest or the smartest, but he found people who were the brightest and the smartest in his cabinet, and then those people supported him.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to find a system that works for you. Now, so for me, I know that physical isolation for me is the enemy.
Really?
I'm not an introvert, as you might be able to tell. And so I'm one of those strange people, as many professional speakers are, that if you take me to a really crowded place, I get energized by that. So if I know that I have a difficult task, and some tasks come more naturally to me than others, I purposely go to a place where I know I'm going to be energized. If I'm going to, I have a mastermind group in person. I have a mastermind group with someone on the East Coast that we do by phone. And we know that we reinforce each other. His strengths are my weaknesses and vice versa. And the very fact that we've been doing this for 4 or 5 years now means that I don't want to show up unprepared to our next phone call. And I see that a lot in my coaching. I used to be surprised when I would give someone a homework assignment and they would, you know, if I had a 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock phone call in the morning, I would get an email from them at 1:42 a.m. or 7:42 a.m. And then they would apologize. And I go, there's no reason to apologize. You might have to apologize for why you're up at 1:42 a.m., but you don't have to apologize to me for that, right? But what you have to do is you create the whole coaching and the whole advice and the whole structure is there that you also don't want to be embarrassed and show up unprepared. We'll do a lot more for other people sometimes than we'll do for ourselves. And the very fact that you're going to do your homework at the last minute at least gives you a way to move forward.
Yeah, there was something I had talked about in my book, Stop Hoping, Start Hunting, about the buddy system. Mm-hmm. And I found it to be tremendously helpful. And I told job seekers all the time, especially during the peak of the recession, you had a lot of people who were inconsolable and just felt desolate and alone. And so one of the best things you could do, whether you're currently employed or unemployed or transitioning, whatever the situation might be, find somebody to buddy up with. It could be one person. It could be two people. In fact, and that's a really wonderful way to find accountability. My girlfriends and I were just all together at an event last night, and we came up with this idea. We're all successful businesswomen, and so we thought of the Gratitude Girls Night. And so once a month, we're going to find a cause, a charitable endeavor to go to and to support and to show our gratitude for everything that we have. And it's just to have a group of people who can hold us accountable. Oh, what are you grateful for? Little things like that to reflect back to you your own greatness and to keep you present to what you're up to in life.
Yeah, I think that's a spectacular idea. I'm going to borrow that.
You can totally steal it.
Some different people.
Totally steal it.
And I think one of the things that makes that work beyond the structure is what you said sort of at the very beginning of describing it, which is you have to surround yourself with people who are at least like-minded. If you went out and those three or four or five people were the most pessimistic people you ever met, and they said, Jennifer, you're doomed. Every goal you have, that's unreachable. You'll never be on talk radio. You'll never publish a book. You'll never get where you're going. That would be horrendous. And it can be a problem. Sometimes, and I do, especially when I'm doing career transition, sometimes it involves couples.
Couples?
Yes, couples. And the reason is, let's say that, here's an example. So working with someone who, she was passionate about the environment. And she was working for one of the elite environmental nonprofits in the country. But she was miserable. And the reason she was miserable, and this was very idiosyncratic, is that she needed to be outside.
Oh, wow.
She would literally stare outside in the afternoon thinking, why am I not riding horses?
Aww.
Why am I not doing something physically active outside? And so she was married, and had young children. And so the process of over several months advising them and working with them and collaborating with them to make a transition couldn't have been done alone. I mean, she couldn't just say, hey, honey, I'm gone.
I'm done.
Here's my calling card. Here's my forwarding number. Please find me.
And so they pray love much.
Exactly right. It wasn't that. And so it was working with them to figure out, and he was fortunate because her husband was in the IT field, and so he happened to have some flexibility in terms of where he could be geographically. And it took about 4 or 5 months, but they did actually systematically, working with me, go to different cities, really get clear about what they wanted. And the biggest thing that they did, and it's also sort of one of the mindset issues, which I think is so fundamental, is they gave themselves permission to at least explore.
Oh, love it.
You have to. You have to. In their case, one of the issues they had, and she had in particular, is that she felt terribly guilty that she was going to take a grandson and a granddaughter, I believe, if I remember exactly correctly, away from her parents.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, you haven't gone on a plane yet. You haven't.
You're already feeling guilty. You're guilty and making it up in your mind.
Exactly right. And I have to say, if there's one useful skill that I hope people get out of this conversation, and I hope they listen to all of your, all of the amazing interviews you've done, but if there's one that I could crystallize for people, is people have this habit, is that they negotiate internally both sides of the conversation. And I can't tell you how often I see this. I see someone who says, well, if I'm going to ask a friend to make an introduction, they're going to say no. If I'm going to ask my supervisor, can I change my schedule, they're going to say no. If I'm going to ask them for more money, they're going to say no. And I'm like, how do you know?
Did you already ask them?
Yes. You ask them. You're having a conversation.
It's an internal monologue.
And it's funny. You never have that internal. Like, how often do you hear the internal monologue be, I'm going to ask, and they say yes.
I just had that today. I'm negotiating on a new house, and I'm like, I really want that patio furniture. So I called the realtor, and she's like, that is a great idea. We should totally ask for the patio furniture.
So if I have a mantra, it's, or like, I don't have many. I don't have, I know you've interviewed people, and they have cute little acronyms
and
this and mnemonic devices. But here's one that I do have, which is close, which is, they can't say yes if you don't ask.
Oh my God, I love it. That's brilliant. Yes.
And so many people don't give themselves permission. Now, part of it, I've realized over time, is because they have a committee in their head. If you ask them, who are you making decisions for? They're not only making decisions for themselves. They're doing it for a spouse and a child or their parents, or they have some societal rule in their head. I'm sure you've heard this, and when you do, I have to stay in my job for a year.
Oh, my God. It makes me roll my eyes all the time.
It makes me go apoplectic.
Why would you suffer? It's like, it's a made-up thing. And people ask me that all the time in the recruiting world. And they say, oh, well, I committed. I just talked to a woman today who said that. Well, I gave it a 3 years. She was miserable for 3 years. And she finally quit after 3 years. But she had this internal monologue that said, oh, I have to do this. Now, there is keeping your word. On the accountability standpoint, it's a very fine line that I will tell you in this, and you can agree or disagree with me on this, but if you give your word to something, like say it's completing a big project, it might not be a 2-year commitment to a job, but it's completing a project. My recommendation, at least to listeners, or the way I live my life, is if I give my word to something and I know I'm not going to be able to keep my word, I'm in immediate communication and then I recommit to something else. And I think that's important, is because as human beings, we only know one another as, what can we count on you for? And that's a question that you get to ask yourself and others, is, what can you count on me for? What can't you count on me for? Which is a dialogue I've engaged with people in the past about. But I think it is a fine line, because it's the whole made up, yes, I have to give this 1 year. Where did that come from? Now, if you actually gave your word to something, if you actually signed a 1-year contract and it's going to cost you time and money, then yes, you have to look at the ramifications. But most of what you're saying is a made up monologue that never actually occurred in reality, if I'm understanding you correct.
Oh, absolutely. It's made up. It's this internal rule that, when I ask people, where did this come from, it's always they, some mysterious they. And I say, I don't know who the they is. I'm saying, because I have been the they. I've been the hiring person. I've been the firing person. I've been the person who's decided on promotions and salary increases. And I've been a lawyer. And I'm like, I've been in all of these discussions, and there is no magical, mysterious they in the room. And I actually, my approach is slightly different than yours.
Okay, because, I would love it. So
which is, it's not, okay, I think that people sell themselves short. And so the fact that you committed to something does not mean that if circumstances change,
you can't recommit or
you
shift.
You can't mention it to the person to whom you made the commitment and say, look, I really want to keep this commitment. Is there something we can do
to
re-decide or to figure something out? And I actually think this is also something that people do in the transition from a job that's just they sell themselves short, is when someone says to them, can you start on Monday? Not enough people say, you know what? I like where I am. I gave them my word. I'm going to give them 2 or 3 or 4 weeks. I had a situation, actually, when I relocated from California to Washington, D.C., when I moved from one law firm to another, I was in the middle of a major project where there were only 3 of us working on the project, and 2 of us were pretty close to being indispensable. Mm-hmm. And so when I got an offer on the East Coast, I said to them, I'm very flattered. This project is going to be done in 8 weeks, and I probably need another 3 weeks after that to move coasts. Would you be willing to do that? And they weren't happy, right?
Shocker.
They're not happy. But then I went to my supervisor and said, here's the situation. And we worked something out, and I left after about 7 or 8 weeks. And I thought I needed 10 or 11 or 12. People don't, look, having changed circumstances in your life, especially when it is something better than what you thought was going to happen, or it's not because of some animus or animosity you have to your employer, people understand that. It all goes down to the quality of the reason and how well you communicate it. I'm sure there are people right now, we're speaking after the presidential election, there are thousands of people who on very short notice all over this country are saying, I just got an offer, I'm leaving my government job, I'm going to the government, and some of those decisions have to be made in hours.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's a reasonable employer out there who says, how dare you? How dare you promised us?
Yeah,
that's not how it works.
I think it comes down to underline what you just said. The key word in your sentence you just uttered was communication, because that's where all upset comes from, is undelivered communications or botched communication, because sometimes people don't actually say what they mean. They won't even ask. Sometimes people will ask, and they'll ask for something different than what they want, because they've now brought their monologue into a dialogue, but they're still not asking for what they want. And then they'll say, well, I really need 3 weeks notice, but they're actually lying. They need 4, and they never communicate 4, and they say 3 without giving the employer an opportunity to negotiate. So you're better off just to say, is there any flexibility, any chance that I could have 4 weeks to start? And then if you need to settle on 3, so be it, but don't go in resentful and bitter.
Absolutely. And then look, and part of it is you have to recognize it's not as if this is a world where things don't happen to you unexpectedly, where people are giving you a lot less courtesy than what we just described. I mean, there are employers out there, you hear horror stories of someone who gets relocated and then 2 weeks later said, okay, your job's ended because some contract ended. They're not giving you 6 months of notice.
Touché.
Right? And so you have to be realistic about protecting your self-interest. And I think this is part of giving yourself permission to ask questions. This comes up a lot in salary negotiations.
Yeah, I would love to get your input on that, because I know that's one of your areas of expertise.
It's absolutely my favorite thing to do, probably. And here's why. There's very little that I can do in life. I mean, one of the things I think we all get into the field we're in because we want to make a difference in people's lives. And one of the things I've been able to do, as I've had examples in my life where literally in 10 minutes, I can make a really substantial financial difference in someone's life. And where else can you do that? Because people don't take the time to realize, you know, if I prepare for the salary negotiations 20 minutes, half an hour, 2 hours, that can make an enormous financial difference to me. There's very little, at least in my life, where I'm getting that kind of financial and even emotional return. I've had clients, to give you an example, there was one guy who had worked for a company for about 11 years, and he was being sought after by a competitor, and they gave him a job offer sometime around November mm-hmm. of the year. And he had been receiving pretty sizable
bonuses. Year end happens every year.
Right. And in that particular field, the bonuses actually get paid. They're determined in December, but they're paid in February of the following year.
Mm.
And this other company wanted him to start right in November. They actually said it's really important that you start before Thanksgiving. And so he was, I was talking to him probably every, a couple times a day during this process. And he wrote me an email that said, I think I'm just going to forgo my bonus. I'm just going to take.
That's terrible.
And so I texted him, which I rarely do to clients, and I literally wrote him in all. I wrote, no, you're much more polite than I am. I wrote, don't you dare, 3 exclamation marks. Because I was offended, and I was like, it's insane and unnecessary. And so we got on the phone in like 20 minutes, and I said to him, okay, can you demonstrate what bonuses you've gotten in the last 2 or 3 years? And he said, I absolutely could. I said, you don't have to, people are going to believe you, but if you needed to, you could provide canceled checks. And he says, absolutely, right? Because I'm dealing with people who are that, they're that analytical. They're like, how do you know you're not lying to us? And I say, look, here's what you're going to go do. You're going to say to them, I'm super flattered. I would like to start.
And sign-on bonus.
But I want you to be aware that if I were to stay where I am, I would be getting this X, amount of
y,
bonus.
Z, yeah.
I can't tell you exactly because it's not a formula that's precise, but I have every reason to believe because I've gotten bonuses the last 3 years and I know generally what we look at to get bonuses. So I'm pretty comfortable that I would get at least, I'm 95% sure I would get at least this amount. And so I literally drafted that email for him, sent it to him.
Good resource to have, Gideon.
And he's like, this is never going to work, being the optimist that he was. 24 hours later, they agreed to the entire amount.
Of course.
And the amount was $60,000.
He was about to walk away from $60,000?
Yeah.
Okay, to any of our listeners out there, I hope you just, you stopped your car, you pulled over, you heard that. And not that you're bitter about this guy getting a $60,000 bonus, but that you understand we all walk away from money all the time. In fact, I'm going to share with you on the air right now something my business coach has me doing to look at. So many of us look at our own self-worth and we have like a limit that we put on ourselves of how much we're worth. It goes back to the negative self-talk. So to any of our listeners out there, you might want to do this with me. I'm going to be doing it over the next few months with my business coach. It's called a money biography. So you take an Excel spreadsheet and start as early as you can remember of any incidences that you had with money, of theft, of assets, of acquisitions, of money accumulated, money lost, and you make a note of the age you were, you put the incident that was, and the emotional impact it had on you, and then you can start to see a pattern of positive and negative programming. And it's not anything to say you're good or you're bad. It's something to start to look at, oh, now that I can actually see that, you're no longer at the effect of it, and it's no longer going to control you. Does that make sense?
Oh, I think it makes beyond sense. And I think one of the people, and I'm going to give him a plug, even though he so does not need it, is T. Harv Eker, The Millionaire Mindset, I believe. The Millionaire Mind, because people do have this unspoken knowledge, or what they think is knowledge, or more of a language, I should say, about what their messages about money are. And a lot of it is literally just giving yourself permission. And the example I gave, he wasn't saying, and I didn't advise my client to say, if you don't give me this money, I'm walking. He literally just said, I want you to be aware that this is the consequence of me accepting the job.
Brilliant.
And they just literally thought about it. And my guess is it probably took 24 hours because given the amount of money involved, they probably had to get approval from a couple of people, go up the chain. But whether that amount, whether it's $60,000 or a dollar an hour or 50 cents an hour, people do not give themselves permission. I can't tell you how often people are not even asking for salary increases. And some of it is with really big companies, and even the HR departments are so much less prepared to even raise this issue. I was advising someone, I can't tell you names, but I'll give you like a pretty good sense about it. This is in the last 6 months. I was working with a woman who was negotiating with one of the 20, 25 biggest accounting firms in the country. And a woman around 30, 31 years old, and this was for her first kind of managerial position. And she was coming from a company where she had a certain salary and a certain title. And this accounting firm was very interested in her. But they said, we want you to take a lower title, and we want you to take a slightly less amount of money, like $2,000 or $3,000 less. And so the conversation I had with her behind the scenes was, look, don't focus only on the initial salary. That's an enormous mistake that people make.
Focus on long-term potential.
Yeah, what's going to happen a year or two down? So I said to her, here's what I suggest that you ask. Say, if I do well, what are the chances that can I get a promotion? And they, so she was talking to the HR person, and the person said, absolutely, we can't guarantee it, of course. And she says, I understand, I'm not asking for a guarantee. And then she asked a question that she so did not want to ask, that I literally like...
Forced her.
Practically forced her to ask. And I said, could you, this is her asking the HR person, could you give me at least some sense, order of magnitude, give me like a universe, a ballpark, if I were to get that promotion, if I were to get that job in about a year or two, about what does that pay?
Hmm.
And there was silence. What happened is the HR department, and this is one of the, you know, going back to the very first question you asked me, how the world is changing. 5 years ago, 10 years ago, when I was an HR manager, I would have been prepared to answer that question. Today, apparently, even at a big company, this company has tens of thousands of employees, it's a nationwide accounting firm, the HR department, like, apparently no one had asked that question. They didn't know if they had the authority to answer that question. They were like, we'll let you know. It took them 2 days to call headquarters, get permission. So few people are even asking, if I get a job promotion, what would that pay?
Yeah, what would that pay?
Is that, does that sound like an unfair question?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think, did the person, she already had the offer at that point, right?
She had not accepted the offer.
But she had an offer. So there's one caveat that I want our listeners to have. This is from my perspective. I completely agree that that is a legitimate question. Once you have the offer, that's it. I tell people this in salary negotiation all the time. I don't care. I hear so many people, they go in and they're like, I got an offer. I was like, oh, so you got a written offer? Oh, no, they just said they liked me. Well, until you actually have a written offer, a statement saying that they want to hire you, you have zero power. Now, what Gideon is saying is what I do agree with. Once you have the offer, that's when the ball is in your court. You do have to be a little bit careful because if, say, the same hypothetical situation in person hadn't yet had the offer and was being this aggressive, I wouldn't necessarily recommend this line of questioning. So I just want to make sure to highlight that.
No, absolutely. And thank you for clarifying. And because I certainly agree with you 100%. Look, the basic, one of the basic premises I have, and this is a key learning point for people, People don't take advantage of when they have the most bargaining power.
And which is when they have the offer.
When you have an offer before you decide to accept it. That's when you ask all your difficult questions. That's when you figure out what you want to do. That's when you ask for, let's say you haven't, here's another ridiculous example of how unbelievably reluctant people are to ask for things. And this wasn't an enormous amount of money. But I had a client who got a job offer. She loved the company. She wanted to go there. The only issue was that they had a requirement that you be there a certain amount of months before your vacation time kicked in. And her sister happened to be getting married out of state before she was going to get enough vacation time to be able to go.
Yep.
And so I said to her, ask.
Yeah, vacation is so important.
Ask for vacation. And it's not like this trivial thing. It's like your only sister is getting married, hopefully for the only time, right?
Yeah, hopefully.
And even if it's her ninth one, she's still entitled to your presence, right? Or you might want to go. And she literally fought me. You know, I think they're going to rescind the offer. And that's one of the things that, another myth that people have. It doesn't mean it's never happened.
It takes a lot to rescind an offer.
It's never happened to one of my clients. I've never, and the reason is because I always want the people I work with, and this is to ask reasonable questions.
Not entitled. That's the difference. I think if you go, and this is the warning I'll give to anybody out there listening, if you approach any sort of current salary negotiation, future salary negotiation, any sort of negotiation you're in with a sense of entitlement, you will shoot yourself in the foot. And I think Gideon's questions have all been spot on because it's clarification. All you're doing is saying, hey, is this possible? Not, oh, I'm entitled to this or I deserve this. If anybody went to an employer and said, oh, I need, you know, a week off for my sister's wedding, it's different. It's all in the languaging. If you say, what did you tell her to say?
Well, yeah, it's absolutely in the languaging. And look, it's not as if she went and said, I demand green M&Ms in my office and nothing but green M&Ms. Because then they're like, who are you? We've never seen you.
How dare you?
Like, you're making all these ridiculous demands on us. part of the question I ask is, how do you test whether this is a reasonable question, is this. If the answer to the question was no, that's fine, we don't agree, would it make the employer look bad? Would it be relevant for you when you're before deciding to take a job? Would it make you think twice about accepting the job? If an employer says, I don't have any good reason, and you told me you need to go to your sister's wedding, and we're just, for the fun of it, going to tell you no, we're not, and there wasn't even a conversation about, hey, would it be unpaid, would it be paid? If they just flat out said,
No. Run for the hills, A.
Find out now, because yeah. Your bargaining power is at its peak. So the way I had her phrase it was literally, look, my sister had planned this wedding, the date is so-and-so, I know that I won't accrue as much vacation
by that date.
Is there something that could be done? And so one of the things that's really important is to ask an open-ended question.
Oh, I love that.
Okay, so that's one of the differences, one of the things you learn about from being a lawyer, the difference between cross-examining someone in court and when it's your witness is, when it's your witness, you ask them open-ended questions. When you're cross-examining a hostile person, you're saying, it's right that you saw the light was red, right? You're not letting them
extrapolate.
They're pinning them down. So employers don't want to be pinned down. No one wants to be pinned down. And so you ask them, so when I had the gentleman ask about the $60,000 bonus, he says, look, here's the situation. Is there something that you can do about it?
That's great.
Now, of course, the questions are reasonable because they understand why you're asking about that much money. They should understand why you're asking about your sister's wedding. And if they don't, I'd rather you know that before you accept the offer. Because let's say, what would have happened if she goes to the job, she becomes an employee the first day, she signs all these documents, and then she goes to her supervisor 2 weeks later and says, I'd like to get this special arrangement that they had never heard of before.
Yeah, we just had that happen with somebody. It happened beforehand. Somebody had an LSAT and they didn't bring it up to the client and they didn't say they were going to go try and take the bar. And then a week into the employment said, oh, by the way, I need a few days off for the LSAT. You're going to put yourself in a really uncomfortable position with the employer when you do that, because your job is to communicate all of that up front. Oh, by the way, I'm considering going to law school in a couple of years. There's this LSAT I've already had planned to take. Is it possible, like you said, is there something we could work out where this could,
Yeah, and I think 99% of the time you can say it. I think there are occasional times in the common example of where you just don't say anything. I have a job interview tomorrow.
Yeah.
You do not go to your employer and say, barring some exceptional circumstance, it's understood that if you're in a current job and you have to tomorrow, you need to take a couple hours to go across town. I've had clients who've had to go fly across the country for job interviews. You can't be as forthcoming, as honest as you would like to be.
But when you accept a new job, is what I'm saying.
Exactly right. But here's what I can tell you. When people find out what you were up to, they always understand why it is you couldn't be as truthful or as forthcoming as you normally would be.
Yeah, and it's just, I think most employers are pretty compassionate, but to Gideon's point, if you get an employer who's a real jerk and says no, that tells you a lot about the culture of that company, and then that should give you a moment to pause and say, is this a place I want to work? So Gideon, I could talk to you all day. You have such a plethora of helpful information that I am so delighted and happy that you were able to be on the show with us today, because I know a lot of our listeners are going to get some wonderful negotiation tactics and other great career strategy information. So if people want to find you or hire you or utilize your services, where would they find you?
Well, there are the two best ways to do it. The advantage of having a name like Gideon Grunfeld. So one is it's spelled G-I-D-E-O-N. Last name is Grunfeld. So you can find me through LinkedIn.
Okay.
You can find me through Facebook, and there's actually a newly formed career group called Career Transitions for Professionals. You can reach me through that. And I will leave it at that. Two is plenty of ways to go find me. If you Google my name, you will find my company as well.
Awesome. Fantastic. And tune in next week. I have a world-famous Chinese medicine doctor joining us, Dr. Dao. And Dr. Dao and I are going to be talking about the five elements in Chinese medicine and how they can actually help you gauge the career of your dreams and what career you're best designed for. Just in the prep talk with him, it was very exciting, and I'm excited to even participate in the interview and find out a little bit more about these elements. If you ever miss the show live, you can always find us on iTunes. at Get Yourself the Job on iTunes. It's free to download. You can subscribe there. And you can also find archives of the show, typically within a few minutes of the show wrapping up. You can always find archives of the show online. And aside from that, I think that wraps up the show for today. So I'm so happy to be back in town with everybody. Happy holidays. And thank you again, Gideon, for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.